Democracy as State Religion and War. The New Political Religions. Believing something is a state of mind that is independent of and irrelevant for the epistemological status of the content of the mental act of believing, of what is being believed. Believing, being convinced that something is true and morally valid, is a psychological phenomenon. It is a personal matter, but it may have pernicious externalities. It is not so much what people don't know that causes trouble. It is what they do know and know wrong. In the 20th century, religious faith has been declining, at least in the West, in the industrial states, i.e., in the power center of the world. Christianity and Judaism have steadily lost ground. Transcendental religion left a religious and metaphysical vacuum. The vacuum has been filled by various ideologies. Violent creeds like Marxism, fundamental or whole-scale socialism, and National Socialism, the socialism that became more and more pronounced during World War II, ruled large parts of the world. Both ideologies are clearly political religions that became state religions. With respect to Marxism, Murray Rothbard argued convincingly that it is essentially a reabsorption theology, salvation applying to the species, not to individuals, as in Christianity. National Socialism was based on a peculiar natural law doctrine, the race doctrine of the Aryans combined with legal positivism, whereas nationalism played only a subordinate role. The German nation was seen by Hitler as nothing more than a suitable instrument. Hence, it was consistent when Hitler, at the end of the war, declared that the German nation should perish, since it had proved incapable of winning the war. Its pseudo-religious character can be seen also by the multitude of references to providence, as Hitler implicitly identified himself with Jesus. In the West, particularly after the demise of those two totalitarian regimes, democracy, functioning as a convention for the handling of power, became the new political religion. The term was coined by Erich Voegelin as the title for his book of 1938. 1 year later, Raymond Aron wrote of Religion Politique and Religion Séculaire. Democracy's credo has all the earmarks of a religion. Above all, supreme values, the main characteristic of a totalitarian system. Thus, democracy treated as a state religion becomes totalitarianism in potentia. The results of an election, even if in practice they are often discounted, are officially treated as if they contained revealed knowledge, revealed by the new deity, the people, King Demos, the vox populi. And the leftist deity of equality now occupies the moral high ground. According to Tocqueville, democracy has always had a metaphysical flavor. The American pragmatist philosopher John Dewey presaged that development as early as 1920 with his famous dictum, "Once we commit to pursuing democracy, it will take on religious value." Creeping socialism now occupies the moral high ground. The most important factors for its success have been redistribution associated with democratization. Never before has life been so politicized as in the 20th century. And war-sprung socialism, which is one of the consequences of the democratization of war. Democracy and creeping socialism are two sides of a coin of social democratism. This made it possible for social democratism to become the new state religion. That it easily can take on a totalitarian flavor has been seen by historical examples such as, for instance, the so-called Swedish model. If democracy has become a political religion, wars are a crime for which non-democracies must be responsible. In case of doubt, the very existence of a state with another form of government makes that state an aggressor against democracies. When discussing Kant's thesis on the formulation of the democratic peace doctrine above, we mentioned that democracy as a form of government legitimizes a concentration of powers, abolishing the separation of powers per se, as, for instance, in the Swedish model democracy with its almighty parliament, facilitates warmongering. Political parties are associations of interests, and hence they tend to form cartels, thereby destroying the competition between parties. The constitution becomes a pseudo-religious conception, by means of which all those who are declared to be unbelievers are elimine, excluded from political competition, and thereby pluralism is abolished. Since the transformation of democracy into a pseudo-religious system serves established interests, totalitarian tendencies begin to dominate. Thus, the totalitarian temptation is imminent in a democracy. Therefore, war becomes a secular religious crusade. This helps to explain the enthusiasm with which democracies enter a war, witness 1914. Today, we witness the crusade against terrorism. Since an ism is an abstract entity, the task of that crusade is open-ended. It will end only when crusading no longer produces earnings in some form, power, popularity, votes, etc., for the top politicians. The political use of the democratic peace thesis. The notion that democracies do not make war with each other is a cornerstone of the New World Order crowd, the ecumeny of the variants of the political religion. The implication is that, if we force the whole world to democratize, then we will have eternal peace. The champion of the democratic peace theorists, R.J. Rummel, spelled out the implication. Quote, "Indeed, with universal democratization, they, armies and secret services, would be eliminated altogether." End quote. This naive argumentation gives the hegemon, at the moment the United States, a blank check for intervention, not only an excuse, but a mission, so that it can always conduct an interventionist policy, not only with successful rhetoric, but with a good conscience, if politicians should ever need such a thing, as well. The country that does not behave in line with the intentions of US foreign policy is denounced in the media as undemocratic. Hence, there is an obligation, due to the new state religion, to send missionaries in order to convert the unbelievers. This way of reasoning eventually leads to a funny argument. Going to war with non-democratic countries solely to turn them into democratic countries makes it less likely that we have to go to war with them. President Clinton came close to such an argument in the case of Haiti and got away with it. There are, however, various problems with the thesis, and hence with the intellectual integrity of this approach. On the theoretical level, we ask, why should democracies be more peaceful, apart from the appearances, which are due to the fact that, as just noted, democratic leaders require tricks and deception to bring their countries into war? The historian will point out first that, until recently, there have not been many democracies, so there is not much historical material for testing this hypothesis. For another, many of the democracies have been linked by a common language, English, and common cultural ties, further narrowing the relevant body of evidence. Moreover, this approach does not address the question of how often democracies initiate wars against others. Answer, innumerable times. Pericles, having grown old, provoked war with Athens' old ally, Sparta. Both were democracies, as the notion was understood then. Incidentally, Pericles thereby ended Athens' dominating position, an unintended consequence. In 1994, President Bill Clinton declared that democracies do not make war with each other. Therefore, he proclaimed democratization as the third column of his foreign policy, a Wilson redivivus. Like his predecessor Wilson, Clinton left the word democracy undefined, vague, and ambiguous. The popular thesis that Clinton professed is falsified already by a look at American history. The Civil War, the War of Secession, was a war between democracies with a single currency. Even in that war, the interpretation of democracy became one of the items contested in the war. The quotation from John Dewey about the religious character of democracy mentioned above illustrates America's missionary spirit of the country of sects. See Describing Social Orders above. In his analysis of America, Tocqueville claimed that, at least since its revival in the 18th century, democracy has been a metaphysical system, a belief system that typically emerges in a religious conversion, appears with the advent of a new religion. In the case of democracy, the credo is the following. Nobody holds sway over me, because I dictate the laws myself. Thus speaks the sovereign, the people. According to the credo of the new state religion, a genuine democrat taxes himself and places his body and life at the disposal of the state as cannon fodder. The people gets the feeling that it has a say, that it too governs. Sharing in the decision-making and self-determination are confused. Mitbestimmung is confused with Selbstbestimmung. The new state religion is immunized against critique simply by the claim that all decisions, even the most perverse ones, emanate from the people, a fictitious, holistic entity. The dominance of a monopolistic doctrine, a monotheistic religion, or a political religion like democracy as a theoretical approach, is the precondition of totalitarianism. Thus, it is understandable that the concentration of power legitimized democracy is per se bellicose in tendency. A war becomes a holy crusade. The vanquished, the unbelievers, are to be converted to the true religion, if need be, by force. The question was raised earlier whether perhaps democracy promotes genocide. It is at the same time chilling and, because of the naivete, also amusing to read that, close to the end of World War II, the frank report of the British Embassy in Washington speaks of a, quote, universal exterminationist anti-Japanese feeling here. The report continues that the Japanese are themselves to blame if it is necessary to exterminate them because they resist democracy. Apparently, the unbelievers have the choice either of converting or of being exterminated because they are unbelievers. In the same vein goes Roosevelt's reply to Eisenhower, rejecting Eisenhower's plea to be allowed to make contact with the German resistance in order to shorten the war. Quote, I have not yet made up my mind whether or not to destroy the German nation. End quote. That means that Roosevelt explicitly wished to keep open the option of genocide. At the beginning of this section, we suggested that the idea that the ideology of democracy ought to be imposed on the whole world entails a totalitarianism in potentia. The two so-called world wars provided examples of that spirit. See the quotes from Nisbet, 1986, in Remark on Motivation of Decision-Makers in General, above. No wonder that American democracy welcomed the Soviet Union as an ally, that the USSR was declared to be a special case of democracy, and that Roosevelt shocked Churchill by writing to him that the USSR was a model, whereas Britain was imperialistic. Roosevelt couldn't care less that Stalin, after his invasion of Poland, was murdering considerably more Poles than Hitler. Shortly before his death, he pronounced that the Poles would not mind being administered by Moscow. Churchill, alarmed by Stalin's mass murdering of the Polish elites, in vain tried to make FDR recognize Stalin's enormous war crimes. The case of Poland is another illustration of the thesis that a democracy is not a reliable protector. The claim that the enemy country, in modern parlance the conflict partner, lacks a democratic mindset has become a central part of the war propaganda. Indeed, the one-man, one-vote rule, the cornerstone of modern mass democracy as a convention, appears to be connected with the military perspective. What legitimizing argument can be given for a particular selection criterion? In the military perspective, unqualified franchise, the theoretical doctrine that membership in a particular species ought to be taken as a criterion of selection, appears justifiable. In other plausible perspectives, it is but a trivial ad hoc gambit designed to make votes appear homogeneous, as we have argued in the section Natural versus Artificial Method of Social Choice above. Headcounting is simple, but the results do not have any deeper significance. In an economic perspective, the state is conceived as analogous to a joint stock company. Hence, the criterion that suggests itself for the distribution of voting rights is how much somebody has invested, how much risk he takes, how much he contributes to the national income. Such a distribution is just according to the suum quinque rule. What a citizen has at stake is his property, and in this respect there are great differences among citizens. Those who would risk much in case of war will exert pressure on the government not to take risks, to be peaceful. Votes weighted according to risk to material possessions and/or according to contribution to the national income or to the contribution to the tax revenue will lead to a plutocratic system. Market-oriented classical liberals will resist bellicose politicians. In a military perspective, the risk-taking or sacrifice requested from a citizen goes far beyond property in the sense of material possessions and involves also life and body, the self-ownership in a Lockean sense. Since everybody has only one life, and in this respect individuals are indeed alike, all ought to get the same voting right. This is just according to the treating like cases alike rule, which applies to all cases where a given cake has to be distributed, a given burden shared. It also has the advantage that the people get the feeling of participation mentioned above. As soon as the military perspective has become irrelevant, that type of legitimizing argument loses its plausibility. Hence, plutocratic tendencies should appear, and a revision of the one-man-one-vote rule suggests itself. Today, however, unqualified franchise has a ratchet effect, a special case of the benefit ratchet effect. Redistributive benefits, once given, are politically impossible to revoke. In democracy, as we practice it today, it is impossible to replace the membership in the human species axiom by another equality axiom. A look at the incentive structure makes it obvious that those who would oppose it most vehemently are the political parties, since they are the main beneficiaries of the system that makes the state the loot of political parties. The unqualified franchise axiom has become a central item in the catechism of the new political religion. Unlimited democracy tends to lead to a totalitarian democracy. At any rate, the idea that the one-man, one-vote rule establishes a connection between war and democracy can contribute to explaining the phenomenon of the warfare, welfare, national state, Roosevelt's lasting endowment to future generations. Since the problem of justifying selection criteria for voting rights would lead us outside our central topic, let's just make some remarks. In antiquity, qualified franchise, solon, was abandoned for unqualified in the Athenian democracy of Cleisthenes as a war preparation. The Prussian three classes franchise was abandoned in 1917, Unqualified franchise and worker participation were introduced in order to motivate the population for more war efforts. During the Weimar Republic, public finance experts suggested the introduction of qualified franchise. Hayek's two-chamber system is a mix of democracy and meritocracy. Each system has its problems. Designing a constitution of liberty is relatively easy. Finding the conditions under which it is plausible that such a constitution will be introduced and respected long enough to do any good, this is the problem. Perhaps an unsolvable problem, since it is essentially the problem of making collective choice compatible with liberty. Pre-democratic thinkers like Pufendorf and Immanuel Kant evaluated democracy, immunized against critique by recourse to the will of the people, as despotism. The majority of the founding fathers of America appear to have shared Kant's pre-democratic emphasis on the separation of power. Since, as mentioned, the concentration of power is war-promoting per se, the bellicosity of democracy is reinforced when it has become the state religion. In this view, wars must not occur. If nonetheless they do happen, then that is a crime for which non-democrats are to be blamed. The very possibility that there might be non-democracies in this world makes the opponent in spe automatically an aggressor against democracy. The original US Constitution adopted the pre-democratic concept of the separation of power, and thus it rejected parliamentarism, stressed genuine confederalism, and implicitly adopted secession rights, which at the time appeared so obvious that unfortunately that stipulation was not spelled out in the document. In modern times, constitutional reality in the United States is a caricature of what the Founding Fathers wished to bring about. In continental Europe, political parties tend to form a cartel, something that can clearly be seen in the Federal Republic of Germany and in the European Union, which is on the road to becoming a taxing cartel of states for maximally exploiting its citizens. Democracy as state religion influences both domestic and foreign policy. The way in which the competition among political parties is conducted strikingly demonstrates that the metamorphosis of democracy from a convention into a quasi-religious system serves the established interests. New parties can be excluded from beginning simply by labeling them undemocratic unbelievers, whatever they may profess. Competition in that area is abolished. In October of 2002, the president of the EU's Commission, Prodi, declared the stability criterion of the EU of 3% to be nonsense. Thus, the last barrier of the Maastricht Treaty was abolished. This ushers in a competition between borrowing states in producing nationally debts and inflation while collectively distributing the cost. Comparison of public and private security production, a model and thought experiment. Violence agencies, public or private. Security is defined as the probability to be able to cope with the maximum possible menace. The higher the probability, the higher the degree of security. What is to be protected is property in the Lockean sense, i.e. body, life, material possessions. The problem of appraising potential public and private providers of security is mainly a principal-agent problem. If a private security is powerful enough to cope with the problem of defense, will it not tend to become state-like? Exercising his freedom of contract, a liberty, the rational individual will check which agency makes the best offer. Higher security at the same costs, or the same security at lower costs. The state may be the provider, but it does not have to be the state. In a world where security production is privatized, a discussion of the peaceful democracy's thesis would be pointless, since the state has disappeared. Let us look at the conceptual background of the theme security production, public or private. A power holder employs violence specialists in organized form for internal security, the police, and for external security and military forces. We all live in states, but in part also outside of the state, from offshore banking to internet contacts. A corollary of the definition of the state as the last instance of power against which there is no appeal to another instance, see section Some Anthropological Considerations on War previously, is that the state is a territorial monopolist in violence. Its main raison d'etre is extracting taxes from the people living in its territory. What distinguishes the state from a band of robbers? It is the most powerful and hence the most dangerous of all bands of brigands. It originated the brigandage, and it is a stationary bandit. This is the third differentia specifica of the state compared to a band of brigands. It should be kept in mind that the state is an abstract organism. The government is its agent corporation. In some contexts, it is justifiable to treat government as a unit, as if it were an individual. However, in some other contexts, one has to attend to the various individuals embodying the government, since these individuals cannot have identical interests. There is no principal difference between internal and external security. The production of external security is a necessary byproduct of a state. The state has to protect its tax base against potential rivals, other governments. Roads, too, are such a byproduct, necessary to move the military forces and to get easy access to the taxpayers. Likewise, internal security is a byproduct, but serious attention is paid to it only when a deteriorating security situation begins to threaten the tax income of the state. With respect to internal security, trust in the state as provider has largely disappeared. Private police has become a growth industry. In the US, for example, 1.6 million security personnel are privately financed and cost about $52 billion per year. In Germany, the privately financed security personnel outnumber the taxpayer financed. The most shining examples are the gated communities. That the public is willing to pay private providers so much shows that the government has already lost a part of its monopoly in violence, and that certain functions that the government has usurped are being re-privatized. Other functions of government have been taken over by intergovernmental or non-governmental corporations. By contrast, with respect to external security today, the only violence agency we know is the state-employed military forces, which hence are paid coercively by the taxpayer. Hence, national defense is the pièce de résistance of the statists, who claim that the state is indispensable. Every violence agency has protective and aggressive aspects. According to classic contractarian theory, the state is a protective state and nothing else. Protection of property, body, life, material resources, etc. However, it is obvious that Leviathan, once the people have handed over their arms to it, can commit aggressive acts against those who have given him his limited and strictly defined mandate. It turns out that the state has more aggressive than protective aspects, and that it is aggressive all the time by exploiting its taxpayers far beyond the resources it would need to fulfill its protective function. It has become a stationary bandit. By contrast, a private security agency cannot turn against its own clients, since they are paying customers, and the agency finds itself in a competitive market. Only a monopolist can do that. If a private security agency can afford to commit aggressive acts against its own clients, it has turned into a state or a state-like structure. It all depends on whether or not there is competition, the best means to tame power. The state is Janus-faced in principle. With progressive democratization, it has progressively overstepped its mandate and taken over more and more functions. It has become primarily a provider state. Classical liberals did not even protest against this development toward a productive state as a principle. In addition to this, the state squanders the resources it has extracted from its citizens. As mentioned above, in mass democracy, the state is simply a mechanism to enable the winning coalition to exploit the rest, the losing coalition, without violence. In this sense, democracy is really peaceful. Instead of government of the people, by the people, for the people, democracy has become, in the memorable words of Arthur Seldon, government of the busy, by the bossy, for the bully. Of the politically inactive people, by the politically skilled people, for the politically organized people, the vote-providing interest groups who have the power to blackmail the vote-catching politicians and who always clamor for more redistribution. The government clearly serves aggressive interests. Stocktaking of the present situation. As mentioned above, the internal security produced by the state is deficient. In practice, only the elite of the political class and some VIPs are really protected. In external security, the European states have relied on the Pax Americana since the end of the 1940s, when, for a time, Germany had become the glacis of the US's defense. The US itself has engaged only in aggressive wars, and it has been highly interventionistic. Vietnam, Somalia, and Kosovo, just to name a few well-known cases. After World War II, there was a multitude of wars, but only wars between states of the fourth or third rank. As a monopolist, the state devotes little attention to the demand side, whereas a private security agency has to attend to it. In the context of mass democracy, vote-catching politicians know that an increase in social expenditures pays off, whereas an increase in military expenditures does not. Hence, it is likely that the quality of the state-provided product will be low and the costs will be high, and that also in this area the state will not work as efficiently as private providers could. The defense agency model for comparing public and private security production on theoretical level. First, a model is presented for individual agents. Then, the question is raised whether or not the model can be extended to collective entities. The model does not have recourse to any value judgment, nor to an image of man, and its assumptions, all descriptive sentences, appear realistic. The type of situation is a three-person game: an aggressor, A, a defender, D, and a bystander, C. Assumptions. 1. Two together are stronger than one alone. Two can prevent that one dispossessing them, and two can dispossess one. 2. D owns some property, and the property of D, the potential booty of the aggressor, as well as the property of A, if any, is divisible. 3. Both aggressor and defender are free to attract allies. 4. Minimal rationality, e.g., the appraisal that something is better than nothing. 5. D is willing to pay for security, and A is willing to pay for assistance in aggression. 6. The pacta sunt servanda principle is respected by both A and D. The incentive structure. For an attack to be plausible, we should also assume, 7, that D, the defender, is richer than the aggressor, which will apply in most cases. And to simplify the model, we assume 8, that A is propertyless. Comments on assumptions. The assumptions are unproblematic. One is trivial. It is explicitly stated to stress a feature of the situation. In the section, Practical Evaluation of the Democratic Method, a model of democracy as a three-person game was outlined with reference to Jassé. The democracy model assumes also that each vote has the same weight, the one-man-one-vote rule. 3 is inspired by Jassé's critique of Hobbes. It is fairly obvious, except in perverse framework conditions. 4 is a reasonable assumption about the psychology of A and D. Everything else would be classified as psychopathic. 5, too, is an assumption about the psychology of A and D, which appears reasonable. Cases where it is not realized do not seriously reduce the model's realm of applicability. 6 presupposes a minimal morality, which may be safely assumed for normal, in the statistical sense, cases. If a social order is not respected in most cases, that order is likely to disintegrate, because in it, non-simultaneous exchanges are too insecure to take place, and in an order relying solely on spot exchanges, people would have to starve. Since we do not assume an efficient ultimate enforcer, assumption 6 is necessary. The assumption of an enforcer would be problematic, and defending it would require a digression on the topics of state and ordered anarchy, i.e. lead to a problem shift. In 3, we made the reasonable assumption that both A and D are free to attract allies. Hence, the key question is, which coalition is more probable? Probable in the sense of both statistical frequency and propensity probability. Let us consider 2 relevant type cases. Case 1, a coalition in favor of attack. If C supports A, they together can dispossess D. In order to avoid quarrels over the booty, they will probably agree to a 50-50 deal. Hence, the realistic expectation of utility payoff, gain or avoided loss the side would get if it won the fight, is half of D's property. Extreme solutions. The maximum payoff for C is almost all of D's property. According to assumption 4, A will prefer getting a tiny fraction over getting nothing at all. In extreme cases where A wants to attack D independently of any consideration of a possible material payoff, he will be satisfied even with nothing. His payoff will be psychological, for example, glee or reduction of pain of envy. Case 2, a coalition in favor of defense. If C supports D, A gets nothing. C gets a reward, which may include A's property, if A has any. D may offer C up to half of his property, less than the property of A, if any, because this is what C would maximally get if he chose to join the attacking coalition. Extreme solutions. The maximum payoff for C is almost all of the property of D, less the property of A, if any. In the limiting case, a pessimistic D, in order to avoid an attack that would dispossess him entirely, may even prefer keeping a tiny fraction of his property to not paying C, according to assumption 4 above. It is likely that a rational C would be interested in finding out the maximum of the expected payoff that he possibly can extort, for example, if C is a mercenary. Thus, he will make repeated inquiries at A and D, and hence the price of security production will escalate up to the extreme solutions. In the end, an indifference point will be reached where A and D offer the same amount to C. In this case, the payoff in both extreme solutions is the same. To make the model as simple as possible, it was assumed that A is propertyless, assumption 8. If so, C would get the same amount whether he joins the attacking coalition or the defending coalition, as argued in the extreme solutions. In a market situation, both A and D would rationally pay any price, A for obtaining a tiny fraction of the booty, and D for keeping a tiny fraction of his property. Hence, it turns out we need another criterion to assess the probability of C's choice. It should enable us to assess the probability that C, as a rational actor, will join the defense coalition. Externalities provide such a criterion. For C, A good reason for joining the Defense Coalition is that he recognizes that one day he may himself be in a situation where he has to defend his property. This is the case if he either is not propertyless or expects to have property later on. If he joins the Aggressive Coalition, he thereby makes property less secure in the social order in which he lives, including his own property, and in general he contributes to undermining the institution of property. His choosing to form a coalition with the aggressor would produce, as unintended consequences, negative externalities that he cannot avoid internalizing himself. Also, the converse holds. By joining D, the defender C creates positive externalities from which he himself will profit. He will lower the cost of security production in general. Of course, in the short run, the profits he could make by joining A could be larger than the costs he incurs. However, this may turn out to have been a short-lived advantage, for which he may later have to pay dearly. For many, it may be tempting to explore the possibility of transposing the model from individual players to collectives, to conceptualize A, D, and C as groups, firms, or organizations. C may be, for example, an organization of well-armed mercenaries or a privatized professional army. If you try that approach, you will ask what is likely to happen if further bystanders enter the scene. Since the incentive structure is the same for all bystanders, they will compete against each other as security providers. Competition will, here as everywhere, lower the costs. In this case, the costs of security production. Thanks to competition, the escalating process is reversed. The maximum expected payoff is deflated because, in a competitive market, free private market, free from state interference, the minimal price will be found out. Thus, in the end, any defender D will have to give up only a tiny fraction of his property to a potential C, a security provider, powerful enough to ward off a possible aggression, in order to pay the price he charges for his assistance against a potential aggressor. The collectives that want to make provisions for their security needs will shop around in the market for security production. The extended model, too, does not make recourse to any subjective value judgment and does not make any unrealistic assumptions. It seems to show that an effective, efficient private security production is not only feasible, but plausible. Is the picture we have drawn too rosy to be true? Is there a hidden catch? Unfortunately, there are at least two. First, the step from the individuals A, B, C to collectives is not justifiable in principle, since the members of the collectives have various interests. The approach turns out to be incompatible with methodological individualism. Not infrequently, the politicians at the top turn out to be aggressors who implicitly wage war against members of the societies they govern. Witness the deceit and propaganda lies exemplified in the historical case study by Joel, outlined earlier. Hence, the assumption of minimal rationality has to be interpreted differently for the political leaders, persons who do not bear the costs of the consequences of their decisions, and for the group governed. History shows that the pacta sunt servanda principle applies to powerful states only so long as there is a possibility that the transgressor of the principle be called to account for his action. Aggressor states will break it whenever they think they can do so without fearing costs, punishment. Think of the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939, where each of the parties to the contract prepared war against the other as early as the 13th of November 1940, Molotov's visit to Berlin, where he submitted Stalin's requests. Which party began the shooting war was largely a matter of historical accident. Whether to call it an assault or a preventive strike is but a value judgment from a particular perspective. Second, there is a real, not merely potential, risk that a powerful defense agency may eventually become a near monopolist, and hence become progressively more like a state. Mercenaries have sometimes taken over the state. After all, states originated in brigandage, or in a mix of defense agency and brigandage. In summary, a contra coeur, we have to abandon an approach that looked promising, unless we assume that the incentive structure for the top people in a private defense agency will be drastically different from that in a state-like structure, unless we are willing to add that risky assumption to our list of assumptions. Some remarks on the possible or likely decline of the state. In the post-World War II period, the situation has been changing slowly but steadily. Major wars have disappeared, mainly because of the nuclear deterrence. Nuclear weapons might become more and more irrelevant because, sooner or later, counter-weapons may appear, like the National Missile Defense and Theater Missile Defense programs. Ocean-going navies are disappearing, the only exception being the US. Sometimes the arms race appears to be self-stultifying. For example, the US B-2 bomber is so expensive that there are scarcely any targets justifying the risk of its deployment. Conscription, a modern form of slavery, has almost disappeared. It was abolished in the United Kingdom in 1960, in the United States in 1973, in Belgium in 1994, and in France in 1996. They all put their trust in all-volunteer professional forces. The FRG may soon be obliged to replace conscription by other forms of national service. Politicians seem to take the Arbeitsdienst of the National Socialist German Workers' Party as their model. The states have become peaceful because they have run out of people willing to sacrifice themselves on its behalf if called upon. The deployment of the NATO Air Force in the Kosovo War showed that the primary interest was to avoid casualties due to enemy action. The deployment of ground forces was ruled out from the beginning. States that have become partially impotent are not likely to engage each other in major hostilities. With respect to internal security, the citizens' trust in the state has largely vanished. This is shown by the growth of the private security industry. We mentioned that the number of such firms tripled in Germany from 1984 to 1996, and that in 1995, the industry's turnover in the United States totaled $52 billion per year. Another sign is the emergence of gated communities from South Africa to the US, where their number reached 30,000 in 1997. If that development gathers momentum, it may lead to less politics. In summary, we witness a decline of the state's willingness and capability to perform its most elementary function of providing security. In view of the felt impotence, states give up part of their independence by forming unions like the European Union. By forming such taxing cartels of states, they make it more difficult for their citizens to find escapes. The private security industry seems to extend its services from internal security to include also external security. As Creveld mentions, the range of services that firms of mercenaries offer is astonishing, and in some cases, security firms count governments among their clients. Some standard questions coming from the military. As proponents of the privatization of the army, libertarians must be prepared to answer some standard questions from the military. The people living in a state or region find themselves in a situation with certain insecurities or potential threats from powerful neighbor states. The first task of a military planner is to identify where an attack has to be feared and how to meet it if need be. Then he must make a description of the potential enemy and an inventory of his military potential. Using the present situation as a starting point, we notice that research and development of a first-rate military power is enormously costly. For instance, to reduce costs, the US Air Force produced scarcely any hardware and focused on software, a decision that proved to be right. The aerodynamically superior MiG-29 was no match for the fighter planes with a more powerful radar. Unless a private defense agency could afford such costly adventures, which seems doubtful, it could not compete with big nation-states as we know them today. At any rate, the potential customers for private security services enter the market for military services with certain concrete demands. They have observed that states, under the political pressure of the lobbies of the armament industry, act in such a way that a particular system is established. First, military advisors are sent to a country, then follow arms sales to those countries, and eventually a big nation state gets itself entangled in the net of that system and finds itself in a war at the other end of the world, as with the Vietnam War mentioned previously. It has become doubtful that the state is the ideal security provider, and it is no longer plausible that it should be the only possible provider. At any rate, the potential customers of private security production will shop around for offers that would satisfy their often very particular security needs. Different countries have different defense needs, often highly specialized needs. Private suppliers of external security production must make it plausible that they can meet the highly specialized defense needs of different countries or regions. The products offered must be tailored to the needs of the people living in a given territory with a given geography. Just two examples. Swiss defense efforts have traditionally been focused on the defense of mountains. For example, building tunnels in the mountains to be used as starting strips for interceptor aircraft. The interceptors would land on a landing strip and then be taken by an elevator to the starting tunnels. Hence, there is a need for a very specialized logistic. All this will be very costly for the provider of defense. Natural monopolies will tend to develop. Will there be a real market for such highly specialized services? Or take Sweden as an example. With its long coastline, it cannot use ordinary submarines, but needs highly specialized small submarines and land forces that can intervene quickly and successfully if the enemy has established a foothold on the shore. Great Britain bought Eurofighters instead of Tornadoes because it focused on short-distance defense and low-level flying. Moreover, a private defense agency has to cover considerable costs for permanent preparedness. It must be able to match a surprise attack by a potential enemy. The preparedness has to take all possible scenarios into account. Preparedness is costly and may cause a problem for a private security provider. A private defense agency must also be able to meet the strategic inventiveness of the potential attacker. One historical example is the strategic genius of General Guderian, who, in World War II, invented mobile warfare. Tanks in radio communication with a command center and operating with air support by tactical fighter aircrafts. On the French side, only de Gaulle grasped the situation, but his tank forces were incapacitated by the Stukas, another innovation in military technology. A second example was the invention of special pioneer services, which, combined with transport gliders, made the French Maginot Line a gigantic misinvestment. The inventiveness in military technology, application of the results of research, depends on the progress in the corresponding basic sciences, and basic or pure science has so far been financed exclusively, or at any rate mainly, by the state, i.e. by the taxpayer, whether he likes it or not. Private research institutions have most often been subsidized by taxpayers' money. Surely the market can offer better and cheaper products, products tailored to the needs of the customer. This is scarcely contested any longer. However, national defense and privatizing the army is the pièce de résistance of the statists. At the moment, whether or not private security providers can meet the highly specialized needs of various customers is an open question. At present, private security providers are probably in a better position with respect to low-intensity wars. See the defense agency model for comparing public and private security production on the theoretical level above. At any rate, libertarians must be prepared to answer the questions of the professional militaries. Epilogue. The question of the link between democraticness and peacefulness may have to be seen in a new light when the concept of war itself is changing and its boundaries become fuzzy. Conventional historians tend to ignore the economic significance of the use of force. In thought-provoking books, J.D. Davidson and W. Rees-Mogg elaborate the thesis that history seems to be largely determined by military technology. They identify eras of civilization, the modern era beginning with the use of the bronze cannon and lasting from about 1500 to about 2000. At that time, we have entered the era of IT technology. Whether this new technology will free the individual from the state's oppression or increase the state's control and be deployed in the war against privacy is an open question. I guess that in the competition between private individuals and agencies on the one hand and state-employed ones on the other, the privately employed individuals will be better motivated. Technological innovations have, as a byproduct, increased the vulnerability of societies. A current conflict changes its nature as it goes. Thus, the targets of Bush 2's war against terrorism gets more and more blurred, while the alliance with other states gets more fragile. The concepts of conflict and strategy have to be analyzed. According to Clausewitz, war is the continuation of politics by other means, but also the converse holds. Politics is the continuation of war by other means. More and more non-governmental agents appear on the scene, and the phenomenon of asymmetrical war has become more prominent. A small state or even a group of individuals show capability and willingness to attack an established military power, sometimes even with success. 11th of September 2001. Wars by proxy and low-intensity wars have become more frequent. Most important of all, with the advent of new sorts of violence, the perpetrators of violent acts are more difficult to identify and hence to combat.